Before we start this week's episode, we thought we'd share with our listeners the release of our Guide to Cyber Markets, slated for an upcoming issue of Insurance Journal. This detachable mini-book is a handy reference to agents and brokers looking to find coverages all year long. So check it out in the April 4th issue of Insurance Journal or download the digital version on Insurance Journal's Research and Trends platform.
Insurance professionals work hard every day to keep people safe. But as technology transforms the industry, how can insurers protect not only their clients, but also shield themselves from ever-changing cyber risks? My name's Elizabeth Blossfield, and I'm the host of the Insuring Cyber Podcast, a bi-monthly look into how the world of cyber and the business of insurance are connected. Russia's increasingly sophisticated cyber attack capabilities have been a topic of discussion within cybersecurity and insurance for a while. But since Russia launched a military invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, renewed questions have emerged about the likelihood of a global cyber war. The Harvard Business Review reports that Ukraine has been an ongoing target of Russian cyber attacks for years, but incidents linked to the recent invasion of Ukraine could quickly spread across borders. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, has said that while there are no specific or credible cyber threats to the U.S. right now in the wake of the war in Ukraine, there have been cyber attacks on Ukrainian government and critical infrastructure organizations that could spread to the U.S. CISA said in a statement on its website that every organization, large and small, must be prepared to respond to disruptive cyber activity. So what does this mean for insurers, and will war exclusions within cyber policies hold up in the face of catastrophic incidents? John Bateman is a fellow in the Technology and International Affairs program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His work focuses on large-scale policy challenges, including systemic cyber risk. In a paper he authored on war, terrorism, and catastrophe in cyber insurance for Carnegie, John wrote that the challenge with cyber insurance is that it's not yet mature enough to fulfill its potential. He says this is partially because of uncertainty about what kinds of cyber risks are actually insurable, raising questions about risks related to cyber war and catastrophe. One challenging gray area relates to war exclusions in cyber policies. John writes that although these exclusions can date back to the 1700s, they had never been applied to cyber incidents until the 2017 NotPetya attack. This attack occurred when the Russian government unleashed data-destroying malware called NotPetya, infecting hundreds of organizations in dozens of countries and causing an estimated $10 billion in losses. But some property and casualty insurers declined to pay NotPetya-related claims, instead invoking their policy's war exclusions. These are clauses that deny coverage for hostile or warlike action enacted by states or their agents. John joined the Insuring Cyber podcast to discuss his view on a global cyber war in the wake of Russia's Ukraine invasion, what this means for insurers, and whether this type of catastrophic risk is insurable. Before joining Carnegie, John was special assistant to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph F. Dunford, Jr. He also previously served as Director for Cyber Strategy Implementation in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and was a senior intelligence analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency, leading a team that produced intelligence assessments for the White House and the Pentagon. Check out our conversation. Hi, John. It's great to be speaking with you today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I think this will be an interesting conversation. I know there's been a lot of talk about cyber war in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And so I was curious just to start off if you could talk about what cyber war actually is and how you sort of define that term.
Well, that's a great question, Elizabeth. And, you know, cyber war is one of those commonplace terms that is bandied around a lot by casual, you know, news coverage or even professionals, but it really lacks a clear definition. I think when people use the term cyber war, they're often talking about one of two things. One of those would be a nation state aggression in cyberspace, one government hacking another country that would be so serious that by itself, that would be an act of war. And maybe that might lead to some kind of tit for tat escalation. I think the other thing that people are often talking about when they say cyber war is when two countries really are at war in a traditional physical sense, like Russia and Ukraine are today, and cyber operations then become a part of that war. And that's really what we're seeing right now. If you look at what's happening inside Ukraine, even before the invasion by Russia, we saw denial of service attacks and widespread use of wiper malware against government and businesses in Ukraine. We've seen the ransomware gang Conti, which is a Russian organization, publicly declare its alignment with the Russian state, although they later tried to walk that back. And then we've also seen a lot of hacking of Russia. And Russian aligned actors. For example, there were alleged hacks of the train system in Belarus, allegedly attempting to slow Russian troop movements into Ukraine. And there have been a number of independent hackers from around the world going after Russia. The thing that a lot of people are waiting to see what will happen is, do we have major, large-scale, disruptive or destructive cyber attacks either against the West by the Russian government or against Russia by Western governments? And a part of the problem of assessing all of this is what you might call the fog of cyber war. Because with all the chaos happening in and out of cyberspace right now, there are probably a lot of events and cyber incidents that are actually happening, but either haven't yet been discovered or disclosed or investigated when everyone is just scrambling to stay up to speed, or it doesn't make the news because there are so many more serious things happening on the ground in Ukraine. It's very hard in this environment to attribute events or vet the claims that are being made publicly. And it's easy to jump to conclusions if there is some kind of cyber disruption that it must have something to do with the conflict in Ukraine. So the term cyber war is very vague and unclear, and the reality of cyber war is very vague and unclear as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's a helpful sort of explanation. And I know that you mentioned the use of malware, and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency and the FBI recently issued a joint cybersecurity advisory, sort of giving an overview of malware that's been used to target organizations in Ukraine. And they said that the agency has been working with its partners to identify malware that could threaten critical infrastructure here in the US as well. So I was curious, what do you think is the likelihood that the US could experience cyber threats to its critical infrastructure in the wake of the war in Ukraine? And how can companies sort of prepare for threats like this?
So we have to admit that no one really knows the exact likelihood. It depends on what's going on inside Vladimir Putin's head to a great degree. And as we've seen with the prosecution of the war on the ground so far, it's actually very difficult to understand his intentions and expectations. The US government has said in most of these warnings that there is no specific credible threat at this time against the United States. But that just means that we don't have specific intelligence warning. I personally believe that the threat of cyber attacks against US infrastructure and other large-scale cyber disruptions in the United States is greatly, greatly elevated right now, maybe the highest that it's been in history, actually. Because what we have is a political situation where President Putin has said that the United States has essentially declared war against him. We're actively trying to destroy his economy, isolate him in the world. We're providing lethal aid to support the killing of his troops. So if Putin is publicly saying that we are essentially trying to destroy his government, his society, his military, I think the intent that we would see from Russia to impose some kind of costs on the United States or the West is very, very high. What we might see then is some kind of cyber strike or series of cyber operations that seeks to impose reciprocal punishment on the United States for what we're doing against Russia. So for example, the financial sanctions against Russia could be met with some kind of cyber attack by Russia on our financial institutions. Or there's discussion now of sanctioning Russian oil and gas infrastructure. That elevates the likelihood that Putin would seek to go after United States oil and gas infrastructure in cyberspace. We've known for a long time that Russia is among, if not the most capable cyber adversary that we have. That doesn't mean we know exactly what they can do at any given time. If we knew exactly what systems Russian-aligned actors had access to, we could do something about it. In practice, we have a sense of what they've been capable of in the past, where we've found them in the past. So we really need to think about potential scenarios. Elizabeth, you mentioned one important scenario, which is the classic disruption of critical infrastructure. So we could be thinking about power grids, water treatment plants, hospitals. We could also think more broadly about things that haven't traditionally been considered critical infrastructure, but still include some kind of systemic vulnerability. like cloud service providers, operating systems, browsers, things that are used in a widespread way across our economy and society that could cause widespread disruption. Now, and then, of course, there could be more politically oriented hacks like a hack and leak targeting our political leaders or something creative we haven't thought of yet. So the bottom line is that the risk is very, very high, but predicting exactly what that looks like is very, very difficult.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. And you mentioned that you see these risks as sort of at their highest level right now, but I know that systemic cyber risks have been a concern for a while, even pre-Ukraine crisis. And you recently co-authored a white paper on this topic. And there was one section that I found really interesting. It said, although organizations now have more tools to sort of protect their data, this has actually led to challenges because it's creating more points of failure, more entry points for these criminals. And this sort of seems like a catch-22 to me. So I was curious, you know, what do you see as the solution for this problem and how can companies sort of make sure they're not only protecting their data, but also, you know, securing the technologies that are in place to safeguard their data?
The story that we're trying to tell here is really zooming out beyond any given adversary or event or conflict or threat and thinking about the vulnerability of cyberspace as a whole. And the argument that we make in this paper is that the individual company, let's say, their ability to manage their cybersecurity, they've got more tools than ever before. They could get sophisticated threat intelligence. They could upload their data to a cloud service provider, which has top of the line cybersecurity protections. They could deploy multi-factor authentication. Of course, the threats are also higher. But even as companies have more tools than ever to protect themselves, the risk of a system-wide event that affects many, many organizations or individuals at the same time, and even multiple countries, has generally increased over time. We can think about a few examples of this. So I mentioned cloud service providers. We've seen large-scale disruptions of service providers in recent years, albeit they've been relatively brief. So the more of us rely on a single cloud service provider, the more significant it can be if there's even a brief disruption in that. We've also seen worldwide hacking events like NotPetya or WannaCry, where the widespread existence of a single vulnerability in many pieces of hardware and software that may be identical and used across multiple organizations creates the possibility of a kind of wildfire in cyberspace or a series of cascading events. So bottom line is that individual organizations have the tools, but the possibility of larger and larger single incidents and cascading incidents, more powerful or damaging than we've ever seen before, is generally on the rise. Now, Elizabeth, you asked the key question, what can organizations do on this? You know, for a small organization, I would say it's really about resilience. So follow the best practices to secure your network, monitor the third-party risk that you have, and really plan for disruptions, and especially plan for the compromise or degradation of third parties that you rely on, including embedded software and cloud services. Think about what that would mean for your organization, exercise for it, and buy insurance to account for it. You know, for larger organizations, there's more that you can do. If you're thinking about a Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 company, you can actually start to negotiate with the third parties whose software and services you rely on. You can try to vet their security. You can try to assign some liability within the contract you have. You can use your bargaining power to get higher levels of protection. But ultimately, the point of this paper is to say that the problem is beyond even what a large organization can individually handle. This is something that society needs to address through new regulations and multi-stakeholder public-private cooperation.
Yeah, sure. And obviously, you know, with the situation going on in Ukraine, war and terrorism exclusions and insurance policies have been another big topic of discussion. And you talked about this in another white paper that you wrote. So, you know, I know that this has some questioning whether claims resulting from cyber war or terrorism are even insurable at all. So I was curious, you know, if a cyber war does occur, would insureds face difficulties getting their claims paid? And sort of on the insurance side, would insurers face any challenges covering these risks because they're so widespread?
You know, and as is always the case in insurance, it would definitely depend on a number of specific factors in the case. And I think it's important to point out because of the wide variety of factors that we could see. So the facts of the case. Already in this podcast, we've talked about so many different various cyber scenarios, each of them could look different when applied then to specific contract terms, which we know vary hugely and are highly non-standard across the industry. Then there's the insurer. We know from the NotPetya case that an affirmative cyber insurer or standalone cyber insurer may have different incentives in terms of enforcing their exclusions than a property and casualty insurer or an insurer that's facing silent cyber coverage. And then finally, there's the court that might be called upon to adjudicate this. Different jurisdictions have different precedents. So that's a long-winded way of saying it's a time of flux and uncertainty in the area of how insurance coverage actually applies to what we've been calling cyber war or state-sponsored cyber operations. Now, I'll give you a few examples. A lot of your listeners may have been following the Merck case, which a judge in New Jersey recently ruled that that standard exclusion language of war generally did not cover any cyber incidents. So that judge said that war exclusions are inapplicable to cyber, and therefore insurance companies are fully on the hook for any cyber incident, or at least they can't turn to their war exclusion. But then on the other hand, a lot of people have critiqued that case and said that it's poorly reasoned and unlikely to be the last word, even in that specific contract term. So we're seeing some flux and uncertainty there. On the other side of the pond, in the UK, the Lloyd's Market Association just published a slate of very innovative new exclusion terms for cyber operations in war. And I think these are a big step forward. On the other hand, they remain to be adopted broadly across the market. And there's multiple versions of them. We don't know which version insurers will actually gravitate to. And even those terms also include some relatively new and uncertain terms whose interpretation in a court of law remains to be seen. We could talk about silent cyber. There's still lots of that. So again, the high level theme here is lots of flux and uncertainty in the marketplace. I do think, Elizabeth, you're very right to point out that insurers facing claims will be facing challenges. This outbreak of cyber war, if it does occur, is happening at the worst possible moment in financial terms for an industry that's been pummeled by ransomware and more broadly by COVID and inflation and natural disasters around the world. So at a time of hardening cyber insurance markets, an outbreak of cyber war is in some ways the worst nightmare for insurers and reinsurers and could be a historic challenge to the marketplace.
Right. Yeah. And as you mentioned, I mean, there's so much uncertainty right now, but you did mention in your paper that one solution could be government backstops to support the market in ensuring state-sponsored or catastrophic cyber risk. Could you talk a little bit about why you see this as a solution?
Sure. And government backstops are things that we've already seen successfully deployed in other lines of insurance, terrorism most notably. And I see it as a potential win-win. So from the insured's perspective, of course, government backstops are very beneficial because when their insurance coverage runs out in a catastrophic incident, the government could be able to come in and compensate them beyond that. How does it then help insurers? Well, insurers have been struggling to define the line between insurable and uninsurable incidents and to manage the expectations of their insureds about the level at which they'll be able to provide coverage, and also of their capital providers in terms of bounding the coverage to a reasonable limit that can fit within a zone of actuary kind of reasonability. So a government backstop would then help insurers by providing some assurance that they only need to cover up to a certain limit. And that could then draw additional capital into the marketplace and stabilize that marketplace. That then has benefits for society at large, because the more capital is drawn in, the more insurance can then continue to mature and grow and become a useful tool that not only helps transfer and manage cyber risk, but also grows to the point where insurers can actually be kind of soft regulators of cyber risk, helping using the carrots and the sticks that they have to improve cyber hygiene across the board. And I would argue that all of this is beneficial to governments, even though governments in this case would be opening themselves up to financial liability. There's ways that governments have of recouping this liability, as we've seen in the terrorism insurance space. And at the end of the day, Elizabeth, if we see a true cyber catastrophe on the order of 100 billion or more losses or insured losses in one country, the government is going to step in, regardless of whether there's any scheme in place in advance. We see this with Hurricane Katrina, with wildfires. If there's a huge catastrophe that devastates a locality or a broad sector of society, the Congress or another legislature will just need to come in and have some kind of emergency assistance. COVID is another example of that. Ultimately, I think it's beneficial for governments to have a more regularized process in place prior to that, so that the assistance doesn't need to be some emergency congressional appropriation, but it's been some kind of smoother, more practiced bureaucratic system like a backstop in which we've already drawn in additional private capital to help support that activity.
Right. Yeah. And that's a good lead into my next question as well, because I know you mentioned in your new white paper something that's been sort of a topic of conversation for a while, but I think is probably at the top of everyone's minds, especially right now, that as nations digitize and technologies become more linked with the physical world, catastrophic cyber events, like you mentioned, can now threaten injury or death or, you know, major economic loss. So how concerned should the insurance industry be about these types of threats? And is there anything that we'll need to sort of change about the way insurers are thinking about risk in anticipation of a catastrophic cyber event like this?
Well, I think you're right about the key trends, which is increased digitization and reliance on digital networks for everything we do in life. So to me, that means that if the cyber insurance market is going to continue to survive and thrive, it's going to continue to have to evolve quite dramatically in almost all areas. So I was just talking about capital in the marketplace. We know that cyber insurance is severely undercapitalized, given the overall amount of risk that exists in cyberspace. So people are looking at creative solutions like cyber cat bonds, insurance-linked securities, backstops. That's one area of evolution. The other thing we've been talking about today is the terms of insurance. Exclusions for cyber warfare and cyber catastrophes, I think we're probably still in version, let's say, 0.2, and we need to get to version 1, version 2, version 3. So a lot of innovation needs to happen there. Pricing. We know that our actuarial models are very limited. We lack adequate historical data. Different companies have different access to different qualities of historical data. And a lot of what we worry about are things for which there is no historical precedent. So modeling needs to become more sophisticated than it is now. And then there's underwriting and claims adjustment. What do you as an insurer actually do when you're seeking to evaluate a potential insured and an incident that's been claimed? Are there better ways of assigning those losses based on the steps that that company has taken and even upfront of evaluating their cyber risk posture and cyber hygiene? And then finally, we've been talking mostly today about affirmative cyber coverage and cyber insurance per se, but we know that as society becomes more reliant on the internet, the cyber as a peril affects virtually every line of coverage. So being cyber proficient or cyber competent is something that every insurance professional in every line of coverage is going to have to be, not just those that focus specifically on cyber issues.
Well, we've discussed a lot of really important points today. So thank you so much for taking the time. This has been a really helpful conversation.
My pleasure. Great talking to you today.
While all eyes are on the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, the world is still grappling with an ongoing pandemic. And my next guest, Adam Levin, says these two situations are combining to create increased cyber risks. Since bad actors tend to take advantage of the current climate to launch their attacks, Adam offers his best advice for how companies can adapt to stay ahead of the threats and shares his view on what could be ahead in terms of systemic cyber risk. Adam is the former director of consumer affairs for the state of New Jersey and has more than 30 years of security experience. He's the founder of Cyber Scout and co-founder of Credit.com and the author of the book Swiped, How to Protect Yourself in a World Full of Scammers, Phishers, and Identity Thieves. Adam also hosts the What the Hack with Adam Levin podcast, featuring people who reveal terrifying, annoying, embarrassing, or infuriating things that have happened to them in cyberspace. Here's our conversation. Hi, Adam. It's great to be speaking with you today. How are you doing?
I am great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it. I know that with the war in Ukraine, there's been a lot of talk about the future of cyber warfare and whether a global cyber war could happen sometime soon. So, you know, I was curious just to start off if you could talk about whether you see that as a likely scenario and what a cyber war would look like or how it could play out in terms of damage.
Well, is it likely? Nobody really knows. I mean, unless you're sitting in the Situation Room with the White House, and even then, the problem is you don't know exactly what the other side is going to do. And therefore, it's difficult to gauge what the reaction could be and how this could escalate or not. So let's just say, let's put the under the file of we're not quite sure if it's going to happen. We do know what would happen if it did happen. And it can be anything from very concerning to scary as hell.
Yeah, definitely. Which hopefully it doesn't get scary as hell, because that would be really difficult for a lot of people, including the insurance industry. And, you know, I've read reports that, you know, while there isn't a credible threat right now, if the U.S. continues to escalate sanctions and Russia decides to retaliate with cyber attacks, these attacks could target U.S. infrastructure technology. And I know that this would be one of those terrifying situations. Do you see this as a concern? And what can companies be doing now to prepare for these sort of critical infrastructure cyber attacks?
Well, I see it as a concern because the type of response and the type of provocation could be anything from a message, which is the equivalent of, let's say, mortar fire, all the way up to full specter, which is like carpet bombing. So it's like baptized or drowned. Is it a message or an international disaster? And, you know, the areas of vulnerability are basically the three. You're talking about financial services, infrastructure, and communication. And as examples on financial services, we all know if someone were to attack the SWIFT system, which would make it almost impossible for people to move money around, if they would do something that could disable ATMs, either in a specific area or do it nationally, depending upon, let's say, what bank they hit, or anything that in any way would make it more difficult to move credit card transactions around. So that's finance. Now, when you get to infrastructure, you're talking about anything like Colonial Pipeline or fuel to food. Remember, they shut down the JBS meatpacking plant with a ransomware attack, to an attack on the water supply. We saw, for instance, in Oldsmar, Florida, where someone got into the water system and was adjusting the level of lye, which could have killed people. So there's that. There's also an attack on the electric grid, which could have terrifying consequences. Operational systems, things that control air travel, train travel, traffic lights. And then you come to communication, which is anything that could knock out cell communication. Or, for example, they could take a social media platform and just shut it down by way of a denial of service attack. And even if they shut down one and kept the others open, the others would become swamped, and that eventually would sort of bring them to a halt. So these are, you know, these are three kind of frightening scenarios that could occur. So now, what are companies doing about it? Well, the fact is that the companies have got to stay alert. They've got to train employees. I mean, the incident in Florida was prevented because an employee noticed unusual activity and did something about it. So business need to anticipate they're going to be targeted, and they have to act accordingly. And there's a wonderful phrase in the cyber world that was coined by Bruce Schneier, who's considered a lion. And it was that if you think throwing a ton of money at security or at technology is going to solve your security problems, then you don't understand the security and you don't understand technology, because you could have the greatest technology in the world, but you're only as strong as the weakest individual that has access within your organization to that technology.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about investing money into cybersecurity efforts, but I think you're right. You have to sort of understand the technology behind it first. And I think one place that a lot of companies are starting is with these sort of phishing attacks on email systems. And you were quoted in an Industry Week article recently discussing the increase in phishing attacks originating from Russia. And you mentioned that cybersecurity company Avanan reported an 800% increase in phishing emails from Russia starting on February 27th, just a few days after the Ukraine invasion. So I was curious, you know, do you expect that these types of attacks will increase due to the war in Ukraine?
Oh, I think they will. But I think they've been on the increase. If you think about it, there was a report a couple of years ago that based on the beginning of the COVID crisis, that between January and June of 2020, the attacks that were, you know, based on phishing that had something to do with COVID, that were COVID related, increased by 30,000%. So one thing about hackers is if they find something that works for them, they'll keep using it and they will do more of it. And we see it time and time again. And the reality is, you know, the scams will be the same. They will be the same. The only difference is they will be wrapped in whatever it is. So for the coronavirus, it was all things virus related, health related, anything to do with that, whether it was contact tracing, unemployment benefit related, because so many people were getting benefits because they were out of work because of the virus, things like that. Now here, the scams are going to be the same, but they're going to be wrapped in the Ukrainian flag. So all that happens is they change up the language. And we have to always remember that the people that we're facing off against, they are sophisticated, they're creative, they're persistent. And whereas we all have day jobs, whether it's raising a family, running a business, being involved in educational activities, our philanthropic activities, we have a day job. But to a hacker, to a phisher, to a scammer, to an identity thief, we are their day job. And people have a tendency to be all too trusting when it comes to what's in their inbox. Because these guys, the attackers, they use what's called trust triggers. Anything that will get you to believe they're the real deal, that they might be doing something either for your benefit or offering you an opportunity which you wouldn't ordinarily get, they're going to use it and gain the trust and then use that trust to put malware onto computers, to get into networks, to turn devices into what's called keystroke logging devices, which means every time that you go onto your device and begin to log on to another website or into another account, that information is being transmitted to the hackers. So phishing works. So does vishing, which is where you get a phone call, you think, from a legitimate organization. And it's designed to get you to give up information, as well as was smishing, which is SMS text-based phishing, which is where you get a text that tells you that you have a problem with something or something requires an immediate response, and just click on this link. And when you click on the link, that's when the trouble begins.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And as you mentioned, hackers tend to take advantage of the current climate. So for a while now, it's been the pandemic, and now we have the situation in Ukraine. So I was curious, are these two situations sort of combining with each other to create an even more escalated threat? And is there any way that businesses will need to change their approach to cybersecurity with this in mind?
Well, yeah, businesses do. First of all, yes, they're combining, and this will continue whatever it is, whether it was first the coronavirus, and then it was the tornadoes, if you remember, that ripped through the United States, whether there are floods, there are tsunamis, massive fires in buildings, you know, wherever there's a crisis, and now in the Ukraine, these folks will take advantage of it because they know that people are, they're focused on the crisis. They're not focused on the kinds of things that they might be doing in order to be helpful to those who have been negatively impacted by the crisis. And that's where hackers move in. You know, for instance, they create all kinds of charitable scams. So you think you're giving to a legitimate charity and you're clicking on a link or downloading an attachment. And in fact, it's loaded with malware, again, designed to do damage and sow chaos. So yeah, businesses definitely have to change their approach. And add one more thing into the mix is that because of the pandemic, remote workforces now are more the norm than they were the exception. And when you have people working from home, or we call them hybrid workers, when you have people working from home, they become more vulnerable. And as a result, the organizations for whom they work also become much more vulnerable. So training is absolutely critical. And for example, businesses have to think about, do I supply devices to my people as opposed to allowing them to use their own devices? Because unfortunately, if you're using a private phone or a computer that's shared among family members, you run the risk that somebody's going to click on the wrong link, open the wrong attachment, see something in their browsing that's going to cause them to provide information, which could be the key to your credentials. And as a result, you have a problem. So one of the ways that businesses have to really change, and some of them will gripe about it, they'll say, well, it's expensive, is that they should provide work-only devices that have software that has been approved by the security and information security departments in that organization, and nothing else should go on those devices, and those devices should not be used for anything personal whatsoever. And whatever it costs is nothing compared to the cost that an organization will bear if it becomes targeted and victimized by a ransomware attack, a malware attack, or somebody gets into their network and steals their data.
Right. Yeah, that's a really important point. And you sort of touched on this earlier in the conversation regarding social media, and maybe this is even more prevalent with the remote work environment. But I know that there's been a lot of talk about cyber war. I was reading a recent article in The Atlantic about this emerging concept called net war, which, as I understand it, is when networks of bad actors use the internet to sort of influence thought and communication in a variety of ways. So is that correct, first of all? And is this something that you see as a concern, especially in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Totally. Totally. There are so many different interest groups now that are floating around the internet. And oftentimes you have absolutely no idea what their real motivation is. And most of them are really designed in order to create chaos. And they have been very successful. I mean, think about the fact that they tried to undermine our confidence in the elections. For instance, in Russia, everybody's getting misinformation. I mean, they're being told that they're simply involved in a crusade against denazification in the Ukraine, that the Ukrainians really are the aggressors, that Russia is simply doing everything they can in order to protect Russian citizens who are in the Ukraine. I mean, these are the kinds of information and misinformation, disinformation games that are being played. And it's a very serious problem. And the fact is, any subject that any group wants to focus on can become something that could turn things upside down. You know, it's not like you're working for a structured corporation anymore, although many hacking groups, for instance, are. But you have these groups and you don't even know who's behind these groups. And just sometimes it's a series of like-minded individuals. Sometimes it's more sinister. It's state-sponsored hacking organizations that are behind them. But net war is very, very serious. You know, just as Richard Clark talks about the fact that think of cyber as an arm that comes out of the sky and has the ability to physically destroy something. Well, think of these net war groups as basically the same thing. Groups of like-minded individuals who can create chaos, division, and frenzy. And that can be part of a campaign to soften up a country so that when you go in there, you can create the impression that you're the liberator as opposed to you're the aggressor.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And you've given a lot of great advice throughout this conversation to companies in terms of sort of boosting their cybersecurity. But given everything that we've talked about, is there anything else you would add about steps that companies, especially smaller companies that may not have as large of a cybersecurity budget, what they can be doing to prepare for increased cyber threats?
Well, I would say that you have to practice what I call, and it's a framework we developed in the book, Swiped, How to Protect Yourself in a World Full of Scammers, Phishers, and Identity Thieves. And we talk about this a lot on our podcast, What the Hack, and that is adopt what we call the three R's. How do you reduce, three M's, I'm sorry. How do you minimize your risk of exposure, reduce your attackable surface? How do you monitor so you know as quickly as possible that you have a problem? And how do you manage the damage? And for companies, minimizing risk of exposure is everything from long and strong passwords or password managers where you assign passwords to your employees. It's making sure that two-factor authentication is enabled so that it's not that anyone using anyone's credentials can suddenly log on. It means that they can maybe get to phase one, but they can't get to phase two until they enter a code, for instance, or they have a fingerprint scanner that they have to get through, or a scanner of a cornea. These kinds of things, or it's something you have, something you know, something you are. It means there's a lot of training about how people just don't click on links and simply open attachments or download every app that sounds new or cool to a device that could be used for your network, which could get someone in. It's making people understand that when they create answers to security questions, they lie like a superhero because so much information that ends up as answers to security questions can be found online in social media sites. It means approaching all of this from a completely different perspective, where you understand the fact that you have a stake, an ownership as an employee in the privacy and security of organization. It's really about creating a culture of privacy and security from the Xerox room to the boardroom and back again, or if you're working from home for a company, from the living room to your home office and then throughout your entire household, because it could impact. It means the second M, monitoring. Like, unlike the old days where you'd find out about a vulnerability, you'd patch it and you'd pray that was enough. You really need to have an ongoing vulnerability management program as an organization that monitors your systems, where penetration testing becomes a normal part of your life. And that also, as part of this monitoring and reducing your attackable surface and minimizing your risk, is also getting cyber liability insurance for a company, because that plays into the third M. And the third M is, if God forbid something happens, how do you manage the damage? And that means that organizations have to assume it's not if, but when, and they have to actually develop incident response programs that take into account everything from how do I close the gap that was created by this particular hack that I now find out is bigger than I thought it was? How do I get my systems up and running again? How do I communicate with the public so that I can calm them down, in particular, my customers, business partners, and the like? How do I integrate my legal, PR, IT departments, human resources departments all together, because they have to be working together? And then how do I make sure that my cyber liability insurer understands that I've done everything I possibly can do, and I'm doing everything I can to not only protect the people that unfortunately have been exposed, but in addition to which, how can I avoid these massive class action lawsuit litigations and losing customers over all of this?
Right. Yeah, that's a great framework and easy to remember too, the three M's. So that's great. And thank you so much for all the work that you're doing to educate and sort of spread awareness about cybersecurity through your podcast and the books that you've authored. And thanks for taking the time to speak with me as well. This has been a great conversation.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks to John and Adam for taking the time to speak with me, and thanks to all of you for listening. Once again, my name's Elizabeth Blossfield, and I'm the host of the Insuring Cyber Podcast, a bi-monthly look into how the world of cyber and the business of insurance are connected. Be sure to check back for new episodes publishing every other Wednesday on Insurance Journal TV and Apple Podcasts. Talk to you next time.